I'm opening.
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, this is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, welcome back, everybody, to 12 Years a Slave, Anatomy of a Movie Edition. Hello, I am your host, Marissa Serafini, and with me, I have...
Dimitri Panos, and hey, everybody, I have to start this off with, did everybody hear? The Red Sox won the World Series! That'll be the only sports reference in a movie show.
I have to get that out of my system. All right. And then we're also joined by our lovely, lovely host...
Siobhan Hughes.
Welcome, Siobhan. Of course, we can't forget our wonderful executive producer and also running the ones and twos in the booth, Mr. Phil Svitek.
Hello, everybody. I'm excited to be here. And Siobhan Hughes, actually, she was a panelist for Black Hollywood Live's film review of 12 Years a Slave, so she has a great perspective on it. That's a really, really good in-depth show, too. We'll kind of be cross-referencing them, but our podcast will be different from theirs. But definitely check that one out as well. Black Hollywood Lives, 100% real.
Yes, and right now we're talking the Anatomy of a Movie version, which we're definitely going to break down and dissect this movie. Of course, we're assuming that you've already seen this movie, so it's going to be chock full of spoilers. If you haven't, I suggest you highly go see it and then listen to this amazing podcast. But let's just start off. The concept and development of this movie, Steve McQueen, I know he was looking for a film. He wanted to do a film about a free man in the North who got pulled into slavery. And then his wife actually found this book, 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. And then he read it and made it his life mission to put this movie into production.
Yes. Yeah. The idea was discussed in about 2008. Plan B executives and Steve McQueen sat down, he was actually talking about this before his first film, Steve McQueen's first movie, The Hunger, was premiering at the Toronto Film Festival, and then Brad Pitt, whose company Plan B, ended up producing the picture with them, they discussed the project with McQueen, and then, the directors started working on the script with, writer John Ridley. So, you know, it's fascinating that, you know, even as his first movie, because between his first movie and now, you know, he's made a couple of movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always find the genesis of a movie fascinating because sometimes it just takes, I mean, it's 5 years, yeah. If my math is correct. Is my math correct, Phil?
5 years, from 2008 to 2013. So it's been a movie that's been in the production aspect for a while now.
Yeah. For a little while, and then, you know, the movie has had, you know, thus far, I mean, you know, we'll start off, you know, it premiered at the Telluride Film Festival on August 30th, mm-hmm. And then before screening at Toronto, you know, on November 15th, Summit Entertainment had secured a deal to distribute the movie in the international markets. And then just a few weeks before Principal Photography, a company, New Regency Productions, came in and they agreed to co-finance the film. And then because, again, this is, you know, one of those great Hollywood stories, because of a distribution pact between 20th Century Fox and New Regency, Fox Searchlight Pictures acquired the film for the U.S. distribution rights. And, thus far, You know, the film was initially scheduled to be released in late December. Mm-hmm. You know, they figured they had a good movie.
And I can understand why, because late December, usually November, like October to even January of the next year, that's the whole Oscar season, Academy Award.
Yeah, but
I understand why they wanted to release it late, later, yeah. So it'd be like fresh in people's minds to remember for.
Yeah, and yeah, season. You know, and you have to release before December 31st to be considered for, you know, 2013.
Yeah.
But what happened is that they test screened it, and the test screenings were so through the roof for the movie. They were like, you know what? We can release this a little bit earlier. So they did. They decided to platform the release, and they went out in October, which for this kind of a movie, you know, when you think about October,
yeah.
You are thinking a little bit lighter fare, maybe a horror movie here or there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it opened
up. It is a horror of sense.
True. But, you know, right. But it ain't Carrie.
Yeah.
And, you know, they opened up in 19 screens. And then.
A little surprising. Sorry to cut you off there.
No,
but
it's all right.
I personally haven't heard of this film up until it was really word of mouth that.
Yeah.
People told me to go see this film, and I
right.
did. And then when I found out that it was only originally starting in 19 screens, I can understand why.
Sure.
I'm like, why isn't this movie more worldwide?
They did that on purpose.
Yeah.
Was it Fox Searchlight?
Searchlight, yeah. Searchlight has released it domestically.
They did
yes.
it on purpose. They wanted that word of mouth.
Yeah.
They wanted that buzz, which I think is a lot more in this day and age with social media is a lot more
sure.
powerful than, you know, getting the well-known critics to – you know, review your film, you know,
yeah.
and release it wide.
And yeah. it worked, too, because
sure.
I was told by people to go see, and I'm telling other people to go see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then, you know, it's already increased by October 25th. It's increased to 123 screens, and this past weekend, November 1st, it's 412 screens.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Fox Searchlight, no stranger to how to platform a movie. You may remember the movie Juno. You know, which was released by Fox Searchlight. And, you know, great. They had a similar kind of rollout. Let the word of mouth, like you were saying, let that work. And, you know, the momentum of this particular picture is going to last all through the holiday season. And it's going, you know, it's weird. We got a ton of blockbusters coming out between now and the end of December.
Mm-hmm.
12 Years a Slave is going to navigate those waters, and it's still going to be talked about. It's still going to be around come the end of the year. And then once that, you know, as you start getting into December, you start hearing the Academy buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And once that picks up, this movie, in my opinion, will definitely be, you know, on the top of a lot of people's lists. And, you know, that'll continue that fuel for the fire, so to speak, and it'll continue to play out.
Right. I think it even helps just the award race for the actors in the film.
Sure.
Like Michael Fassbender said, he just after the whole tremendous effort of campaigning last year for Shame, he's like, I'm not doing it again. So I think this year we can safely say he probably doesn't need to do much.
You know, my whole thought on that, and I get it, and I respect him saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me, you know, Fox Searchlight, if they want him to really push, they will pay him to act like a nominee. So, you know, and yeah. he'll most likely take it. I'm sure he'll do an interview or two. You know, I get what he's saying, and we can talk about the Academy Awards and politics later on, but I totally see where he was coming from, you know. I think that, you know, the other cool thing about this movie is that, you know, when you talk about opening on 19 screens, its opening weekend was $923,000. So, you know, we're almost at $1 million on 19 screens. That's incredible. And to date, since then, you know, it's up to $9.4 million as of yesterday, November 5th.
Yeah.
For a movie that's on 412 screens, that says something.
And
it's a freight train.
It talks about the little movie that could, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Because, and what different about this movie is that the story, what's going on in this film will last forever because it is based off a true story of Solomon Northup, a free man from New York
right.
who was captured into slavery and was forced to be a slave for 12 years. But because this movie is based on a true story, it touches upon all the racial problems that America had back in the 1800s when all this really was happening, and this movie felt kind of like an Anne Frank type of biography to me, but this movie happened way before World War II even happened, so I think the prevalence of what's happening in this movie will last, will have legacy, and even though people didn't see it, a lot of people didn't see it as much as they should, it will still have its legacy.
And I think people will go out to see it. I think it's a, I think it's a very important movie. I had read a review over this past weekend that came from the Boston Globe, and I believe the writer of the article, the review, was Ty Burr. And he said of this movie, he's like, you know, as far as American history go, this is the American history. This is our Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And when I thought about that, it really is. For me, watching the movie, I had to keep on reminding myself that it was a true story because I'm a big science fiction fan. And this has the makings of like a Twilight Zone kind of a movie where you take your everyday guy, has a normal life, wife, kids, and then he's ripped away from that. And he's thrown in, his identity is stripped, he becomes, you know, and there's usually a morality tale. And I had to keep on saying to myself, but this really happened. Yeah, it happened. And then it makes you think like, man, as a species, we suck. Like, we are, as an entire species, like, you get, I'm going to throw another science fiction, the day the Earth stood still. You get why people, if people were to look at Earth from outside and look at our history, we're very violent, we're mean to one another. And I guess, you know, we have to take that, you know, we have to take hope. We have to, you know, finally we have to look at hope and that we can become better people. But what happened in 1841, it's still happening today, you know, in the cases of human trafficking. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and now we're being, you know, sex slavery and, you know, kids are being, you know, mm-hmm. as much as things have changed, and I like to believe that we've become better people, mm-hmm. you know, a lot hasn't. Yeah. And it's frightening.
I mean, I think with movies like this, they are hard to watch and hard to accept, but they're needed just to, you know, that, you know, the quote, you know, those who do not know their history are doomed to repeat it.
Right. To that point, exactly. I think this movie is very much, I think thematically, remember how many times is he trying to write that letter? And the movie, in fact, opens up with that, you know, him trying to just piece anything together to make ink in order to send out this message. And I think partly, you know, thematically, the movie is something like that where, you know, in whatever way it can get out there, it's trying to get out there into the consciousness of, you know, America, but, you know, the world as well.
Yeah.
Yes, and exactly. And this movie kind of goes against that whole Hollywood, that one-man hero protagonist. And and that Hollywood stereotype. We have this one-man Solomon Northup, and the thing is, we see throughout this whole movie his endurance, his will to survive. And there, I believe there's a line that he's like, I don't want to survive, I want to live.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is so true. Because fighting for survival is, that's fighting every day just to live. But when you're living, you don't have to worry about survival.
Yeah. No, and there's another, it was my favorite line in the movie when, you know, talking about his survival. And I said it, you know, I will keep myself hardy until freedom is opportune. Mm-hmm. And he did his best to do whatever he could to survive until such opportunity. You know, he, again, when you, going back, tying it back to my hope message, like, there was hope for that. There was hope that at some point there is going to be an opportunity for me to either tell my story to somebody who's sympathetic and empathetic to me, that I'm like, and hopefully this will not last for the remainder of my life, and I have to live on that string of hope to get back home.
I'm curious though as to why, like, that boat scene when they're being shuttled down to wherever mm-hmm. they're being sold, like a lot of the people already had seemed to have given up, and I'm curious as to why his character in particular was not going to do that.
See, and I think to go off of that Solomon Northup, we know he was an educated man. Mm-hmm. He had the intelligence to understand and conceptualize what was happening and really comprehend the situation, whereas I think the other people, yes, they were still free, but I don't think they had the exact intelligence level mm-hmm. as Solomon has. And statistically, people who are more educated can deal with stressful situations mm-hmm. better than those who aren't.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there was a character that I believe he met. I believe it was on the boat or just before getting on the boat. There was a character that he met, and the guy said, look,
Don't say anything.
Like, if you want to live, if you want to make it through, just do what they tell you. Don't say anything. And whatever you do, don't lead on that you can read and write and do all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think he sort of kind of took that to heart. And, you know, when he looked at the other characters around him, you know, he tried to, I'm trying to think of, what was her name? Patsy. Mm-hmm. You know, Patsy, who was trying, I mean, that was a tragic story as well. He was trying so hard to instill that upon her. Like, listen, you gotta live. You to live, just do this. And then, you know, we'll try to make this work. But, mm-hmm. but first we gotta live. And mm-hmm. you can't do anything if you're dead. And
you know, I think, you know, for me, one of the really interesting aspects of this movie was the idea of resistance, right? And how one goes about it, you know, in terms of nonviolent resistance. Obviously, you have Dr. Martin Luther King and things like that as a real-life figure. And then, you know, maybe Dimitri knows this reference, but the old British Prisoner TV show. Remember, it was the epitome of how to kind of, in television form, how to do non-resistance. Right. And what I liked about that is that, you know, here's Solomon, and he's trying to gain his freedom, but passively, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. very, very selective with the actions that he actually does make. And most of the things that happen to him are very circumstantial. And especially, you know, with Patsy, you know, she's kind of caught in the crosshairs of you know, the owner, the male, and the owner, you know, female. And, right. and no matter what she does, it, you know, she's just caught in the crosshairs of that and it's punished for it on both sides.
Yeah, agreed.
Exactly. And to go off that, so the acting in Patsy and, of course, that our lead character, and I hope I don't butcher his name, Chiwetel?
Chiwetel
Ejiofor. I have it on very good authority that his nickname is Chewy.
Because,
you know, he's and I do have that on very good authority. So I think I'm just going to call him Chewy. No disrespect. I don't know you, sir. But and it's a great name. Take it from a person mm-hmm. whose name, you know, had to grow up with the name Dimitri and couldn't change it or shorten it. You have an awesome name. So but Chewy, yeah, I thought he was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like, fantastic.
I think this whole cast was phenomenal. Yeah. They yeah. all had their standalone moments.
Absolutely.
That really allowed them to just showcase their acting abilities in such a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that even goes down to Elfie Woodard with her 5 minutes on screen. Yeah. Not even 5 minutes on screen, but it just goes to show the talent within everyone in this whole casting
sure.
from Fassbender to
Sarah
Patsy.
Pauly.
Sarah yeah. Paulson.
She wasn't there long, but she had a big impact.
Absolutely.
But all of them, so talented. Sarah Paulson. And but Chiwetel, I haven't really seen him in anything else. So he definitely will stick back in the back of my mind, and like I hope to see him in bigger.
Well, it's funny things. Because I actually have casting trivia for both Chewie and Sarah Paulson. I remember Chewie from the first movie I ever saw him in was in the movie Serenity, which is based off of Firefly,
right.
And he was the big bad. He was Joss's big bad in that. And if you remember the movie, he was the guy that would like sort of kind of punch in the back, hit that nerve cluster, paralyze you, and he'd have the person fall on the sword. And he was Mal Reynolds' nemesis. And he was – I remember seeing the movie, and I'm a big Firefly Serenity fan, but I was like, this guy's great. I don't know who he is, but he was fantastic. And, you know, he's been in movies like Kinky Boots. He was amazing in Kinky Boots and Inside Man, and you know, he was in Salt as well. And every performance, I always notice this guy, he's got a presence. He's got a great presence mm-hmm. on screen. I think this movie, you know, to me, you know, he was really given a great, it's one of those, you know, opportunity of a lifetime roles. Mm-hmm. And I thought he took everything that he's, you know, embodied in movies, and he was just fantastic. I mean, to me, nomination worthy.
He initially didn't want it. He was given the opportunity. He was like, this is too big of a role. It's very intimidating. I don't know very many actors who would just jump straight in like that.
Sure.
But he said that this role is changed his life like no other roles, like the ones you mentioned before, have done.
Yeah, I can understand his hesitation, but I got to give him applause for allowing himself to step into such a serious type of movie and such a serious, real story that happened.
Yeah. I also think that it's it also says a lot about the director, Steve McQueen. I think that, you know, you're able to get these kind of performances out of people because they do have respect for that movie making process and for your director. Mm-hmm. And as a director, he got what he wanted out of his performers and his shots. And, you know, to me, when a movie works on all cylinders, mm-hmm. It's because it is a whole cast and crew effort. And, you know, I think, you know, great props to Steve McQueen. And I think his actors showed him the respect and they really stepped up. And we've seen some people, even somebody like Paul Giamatti, who, you know, again, only in the movie for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, you look at him and what an ass. And
yeah, because he slaps him.
Yeah.
He slaps Solomon right off the bat. And he kind of sets the tone for all the white men that were about to see.
Sure.
All the slave owners that we're about to see throughout the movie.
And again, from a screenwriting perspective, that character's name, Paul Giamatti's character's name, was Freeman. So you look at that symbolically, ironically, right? But yeah. That was his name. I mean, if you're going off of a book, that was his actual name. And, you know.
And to me, what I look at his character, the subtleties to me are amazing in the sense that he's making so much light of the situation on purpose, specifically mm-hmm. for the buyers, right? You know,
right.
Because you could see kind of all of them are half torn about this, especially if families are being torn apart. And the fact that he's so just business-wise and comedic, you know, about everything that's going on, for the white owners, it kind of does slightly lighten the mood.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where eventually, you know, finally they bring the woman back and the wife comes out and she's like, just eat up. You'll forget about your kids soon enough.
Yeah.
Like she was an animal or something. Like she was like a dog being separated from
property. Right.
Property.
Pups, property. You know? And they kept saying that line, it's human property.
Yeah.
But it's not a person. It's a thing that's tangible and you can pass along from thing to thing.
Yeah.
It's
and
it's so inhumane.
Agreed. And, you know, it's funny. We'll go back. I know we should go back to the acting, but
yes.
Since you mentioned property, you know, Michael Fassbender's character kept on, Edwin Epps, he kept on saying, you know, I'll treat my property. It's my property. I'll treat it as mm-hmm. as I feel fit. And wow, like if that's the way you treat your property, like it just made me wonder, well, you're not treating your fields that way. You're not like, The word property has so many different meanings. I found, like, you know, it's like, you know, you treat your body as a temple. Well, mm-hmm. his whole thing was like sort of kind of you treat your property like a temple, especially when it came to his cotton. Yeah. But yet the people that he called property, he treated them like garbage. So it was mm-hmm. a contradiction to me, you know, as to property. But we could talk Michael Fassbender since we're, you know,
yes,
his performance.
Mr. Edwin Epps. I thought Michael Fassbender was amazing. I had just recently seen The Counselor, which is also out in theaters as of right now. I saw that before. I saw 12 Years a Slave, and Fassbender is the protagonist in that movie. Mm-hmm. And it's a completely 180 role than what, because he's the good guy in The Counselor. And you feel for him, and then in this movie, he's the complete opposite, and he's so gut-wrenching to watch, and he's so brutal and cruel to everyone and everything he does, and it's just, I had a hard time believing it, because I just saw The Counselor, I was like, wow, this man is so sociopathic, it was mind-blowing.
Ice in his veins.
Well, you had mentioned, like, the director before, Steve McQueen, with his actors. And
sure.
Fassbender, I remember seeing a couple of interviews, and he always had said the same thing in regards to Steve McQueen's style, which was that he allowed everyone to fully live in their role, and that it was just safe environment and safe set that, you know, if you would drop the ball in some way, there'd always be someone there to help you. And they said, and he said that, because of this, they were able to get certain moments that, given it was another set or another director, would have been impossible to get.
I agree. Yeah. And again, it just, they've worked together before.
Mm-hmm. Several times.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there was one scene in particular Well, I mean, a couple, but there was one that really stands out to me, and that was the scene where he comes up to Solomon, puts his arm around him, and he tells that. He goes, so, he's like, I understand that this Armsby gentleman, you were writing a letter. He goes, you write a letter, and you were going to have him deliver it, and you know, he didn't know what to do, and he's like, no, I tell you, sir, I did not do that. I can't write. I can't do anything. And Fassbender was just staring at him.
Mm-hmm.
Not one line, and it just hung. And he just looked at him. And you just, it was so uncomfortable. And I could have swore it. To me, it felt like it was like 15 minutes, and it was probably only like two.
Mm-hmm.
But on screen time with no dialogue, 2 minutes is a long time. And, but he held it. And yeah, it was, he was really good at being really bad, but he was, again, I think nominatable, and unless somebody for supporting actor, you know, he would be the person that they're going to have to try to knock off whoever gets nominated.
Oh, definitely. And the other supporting actors that we should also talk about, Benedict Cumberbatch, he was also in this movie. He played Ford, the first slave owner of Solomon, the more nicer, more caring, I guess you can say, slave owner. And I appreciated Benedict in this movie. I thought he did really good. I felt for him. He didn't seem like the mean guy that we were expecting. He was a complete opposite of what Edwin Epps was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, from a movie standpoint, slavery, obviously not a good thing, and when he gets kidnapped and he's on that boat and he's being sold, you know, this is atrocious, this is atrocity, and from a movie standpoint, you just expect it to get, like, worse. And he ends up with Benedict Cumberbatch. Now, he's still a slave, but you were expecting worse. You were expecting, actually, Michael Fassbender. Mm-hmm. You're expecting that right off the bat. So when you have a character like Ford, was that character's name, come in and actually, I almost got the sense that Ford knew that Solomon may have been a little bit more educated too, you know, and, but he was happy to have him because he did increase productivity, through his smarts and his engineering.
Education.
And, you know, he awarded that in the way you would expect people to reward something, but in the back of your head, you still got to say, he's still a slave.
Yeah.
He's still property.
But when those moments where he would see, where he would recognize that Solomon wasn't a normal slave, per se, I think it was, there were glimpses of him noticing that. He's like, oh, well, I got this great slave. He's so smart. He plays the violin. You know, almost he was proud of him as an object rather than as a friend.
That's a great way. Yeah, it's absolutely.
So, yeah.
Proud of him as an object,
I thought how Ford treated Solomon was really interesting because we see he even gives Solomon a little bit of power. He gives him a little bit of authority to spearhead this engineering project that they were working on going down the river. And then so he gives Solomon a little bit of freedom and authority.
Sure.
And then so kind of building his character in that way instead of breaking him down. And then when Solomon was actually successful in the project, he rewards them with a violin, which actually helps Solomon throughout his whole years of all the slavery and servitude. Mm-hmm. And because the violin, it was Solomon's peace of mind. It helped. It was his safe haven, I guess. It helped him with the music and made him had him go to like his happy place, and it helped him survive over the years. And it was also his other ways of making money on his own.
Sure. You know, but then, you know, then unfortunately, there's always the fly in the ointment. And this one is played by, and the character's name is Tibbetts, or Tibbetts, right?
Yeah.
You know, played by Paul Dano, who, you know, I don't know the gentleman. I'm sure he's a really nice guy. I'm sure he's great to everybody. But, man, this guy gets creep of the year. Earlier this year, you know, you see him in Prisoner. And in this movie, he's just, again, he's just downright nasty. And the introduction of that character, again, another very uncomfortable scene. with him singing his rhyming song, and it was just...
You can say it.
You're
not going to say it?
I'm not going to say it because I was uncomfortable. You know, I appreciate it, but yeah. I was uncomfortable listening to it.
Yeah.
And the mere fact that it kept on going.
Yeah.
Yes, and it kept going.
It kept going. And, you know, that Paul Dano, man, and he was jealous of this man.
He was threatened.
And he was threatened.
He was threatened by Solomon's education. And the fact that Solomon stood him up and embarrassed him made him even more angry.
Yeah. And I think for, again, when you talk about a movie, and this happened, but, you know, from a movie sense, you know, how cathartic was it when Solomon beat the crap out of him, you know, in a sense that's, you know, you know that there's going to be consequences, but man, it was just so like, damn, like if anybody deserved it, you know, it was him. And, you know, you could tell Solomon had reached his breaking point. And, you know, then it led to that, one other very uncomfortable scene where, you know, it was more or less the lynch mob. Tibbetts comes back with his cronies. And they proceed to string them up.
That scene, and I give it to the direction of this, that it lasted so long on Solomon. He was just literally hanging for his life. If he had slipped like 1 or 2 inches, he could literally hang himself. And in the wet mud, and the shot was on him for so long. I felt so bad. And then you can slowly see all the people like appearing in the background,
like it's normal
and
every day
they can't help him. I'm sure they want to help him, but it would cost them their lives too.
I wonder what the Foley felt like, you know, like the doing the sound effects, which is like.
Well, I can, you know,
and that's what we'll talk about more about sound effects too. But the sound effect in this particular scene, it was so subtle, but yes, so effective because we're seeing this man hang. It's so still. But and then the little soft sound just made it like amplified everything.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily mean to read, but I picked up this. There was an interview with Sean Bobbitt, who's the cinematographer on this movie, and he was specifically asked about this scene. And you know, he was like, you know, to him, he said this was the absolute crucial scene because it exemplified and embodied what slavery was. He goes, I mean, here's a man on the edge of death and no one can help him because he belongs to someone else. Mm-hmm. He goes, it's difficult to comprehend in an abstract way. He goes, but hopefully the emotional effect of it is heightened by the fact that you are not let go. And it continues to play on. And if you weren't, his quote is, if you weren't squirming in your seat by the end of it, then we kind of failed. And yeah, well, he succeeded. Mm-hmm. And my only question is, I'll throw this out to the group is, so you had Ford's second in command, so to speak. Okay. Mm-hmm. He comes to, I'm going to say he sort of saves the day because he runs Paul Dano's character, Tibbetts, off and his cronies off. Mm-hmm. But yet he left him there. Like he left him there, and hence we get that long scene, and it's Ford who comes back with the axe and chops the rope when he was there. And I always wondered, dude, why couldn't you just
let him go?
But if it goes back to what Sean Bobbitt said, because perhaps he was looking at it
wasn't
his property.
It wasn't his call. It was his authority to put Tibbetts in his place, but it wasn't his property to do with whatever he wanted to do with Solomon.
Yeah, because that's the way he in turn makes his money. So if he's down one slave, it's less money coming in, and he could also lose his job, you know.
Yeah, because Ford still had a debt to pay with Solomon. That scene was definitely one of the better, well, definitely cover more scenes and dissect them a bit, but that was definitely one of the first really standalone scenes by itself, which was really effective.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very effective. And just, again, it was one of those scenes that it's a one-take scene.
Mm-hmm.
And, just highly, very uncomfortable up until, you know, Ford or Benedict Cumberbatch's character comes in. It was good to see Benedict Cumberbatch play sort of like a, you know,
a nice guy.
Yeah.
He's all over the theaters this year.
Oh yeah.
Good for him. Good is for what him. I say.
I just want him seeing back in Sherlock.
Yeah.
That's his first priority.
It's coming. But, it's coming.
After this particular event, Ford cuts him down. Mm-hmm. He told Solomon that he's been sold to another slave owner, which we go to.
Only because.
Epps, of course.
You know, only. Well, but only because Tibbetts was.
Gonna come for him.
He was coming back to kill him.
Yeah exactly. And he said once Tibbetts has it set in his mind, he's gonna make sure it's done. So he was pretty much protecting his slave. Mm.
And I think he was protecting him himself as
so
well.
So was it really that far beyond Tibbetts's. I don't know, ability to go travel to wherever this other slave is being sold to kill him there? I think it might have been about more than just trying to save Solomon from Tibbetts?
Well, I think there was property issue. I think Cumberbatch's character Ford, I think he was thinking of his family not getting caught in the crossfire because mm-hmm. it seemed like this guy was going to come in, storm the house, and start shooting.
Yep.
And I think he was upset, too, with Cumberbatch because, Ford didn't stand up for him. But to your point regarding mm-hmm. Tibbetts, I was just wondering if perhaps it almost seemed to be almost secretive because we got to get you out of here. I've tried contacting some people, but we're going to sneak you out of here tonight. And with, I don't know. That's the one thing. I never got a geography, so I didn't know how far off Edwin Epps's plantation was from Ford's plantation and how far they had to travel. So, maybe it was far because he said,
I talked to other people to sell you, but your reputation precedes you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I can't sell an educated slave to anybody right now.
But
so he had to go probably very far away.
Yeah, and then we get to Edwin Epps, and again, Michael Fassbender, chilling performance. Most likely, I can't see him not getting nominated for Best Supporting Actor. You know, but his mistress Epps.
Yeah, I was just gonna say his
Sarah
mistress
Paulson.
Epps, Sarah Paulson. I've known her for the more lighter comedic roles, and this was completely different from what we're used to seeing her. Mm-hmm. So cold, so very sociopath, and kind of emasculating towards Epps, mm-hmm. and puts him in his place because she's always saying, how to treat Patsy and whatnot. And just throwing glass at slave's face, the cruelty in her. And she coerces Epps to do certain things to Patsy. Makes me wonder how many actions that Epps did to these slaves were really his mistress saying all this, and he's just executing them rather than just Epps in his own dark demeanor.
Yeah, I found a lot of her anger was fueled by Edwin, in a sense, because of, for his indiscretions, and plenty there may be, and her anger towards the property, the slaves, was different because of her husband's actions and what he did. Listen, that scene where she throws a scotch decanter. Mm-hmm. Now, listen.
That's heavy, too.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
I drink scotch. And not only are they heavy, some of them, that one was square. That could do damage. That is not going to break, and it didn't. And when that happened, again, a scene where I think everybody in the audience I saw it with was like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Left
field.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You had no idea that was coming, which made it more effective.
And it was a scotch. It was a heavy decanter. Mm-hmm. Again, another, the species really sucks.
Yeah, Phil, what were your thoughts on the mistress and Edwin Epps?
I can't help but go to the guy who eventually remember he used to be an overseer, but then was too drunk.
Oh yeah.
Right,
Gary Dillahunt, Armsby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so where he says, there's no way that you can kind of whip anybody without it taking your soul, and I can't help but put that into Epps because ultimately, as evil a guy as he is, my question is, how much of a soul does he have left? And because the mistress is not doing these actions directly, you know, she's forced him to do it. And because it's a byproduct of her that he's lost his soul. And, you know, and I also think that she ultimately doesn't have a soul either because she's disattached from all of this.
Yeah, it's a great observation. And speaking of Sarah Paulson, not too long ago, I said, hey, I have some casting trivia. Both Sarah Paulson and Chewie were in Serenity together.
She was the doctor in...
She was the doctor.
Yeah, in the video.
She's the doctor in the video. So I'm not sure if they had screen time together, if they even met, but they were in one movie together previous. So.
Question, let me ask you guys this.
Yeah.
Because obviously throughout the whole movie... you know, he stayed true.
I didn't do it.
Chair problems.
I'm just glad I only went down a slight bit. Went down the hallway. Ooh.
Anyway, so ratings. Throughout the whole movie, right, there's the notion of, right, fidelity, infidelity and all that. But for Solomon, it was, I always got to get back to my family, so he always stayed true to that. But there were obviously advances on him, and I think Sarah Paulson's character partly did that at times, but he didn't. You know, maybe I think he recognized it, but I don't think he obviously pursued it. Would you guys say that's the truth?
Oh, when you mean when Sarah Paulson's character, Mistress Epps, sends him on grocery errands and stuff?
And she also, you know, they have their little moments. I mean, they're not really big. That's why they're really, really subtle, unlike what Epps was doing, which was, you know, very outright. But I think she was testing the waters and trying to use him as a way of getting back at him.
Yeah, that makes sense. Definitely. Because she did catch on. I mean, he let slip that he could read. You know, when she the first time she gave him a list, he said, "Get this from the general store," and he opened it up and he read and she goes, "Do you know how to read?" And he's like, "No." But I think it was led on, and I mean, to your point, Phil, I think that's a good point.
You know, especially one of the reasons why not only can read, but he's also the one slave that's really angering Epps, and so, you know, what's the easiest way of getting back at him?
Be nice to him.
Yeah, in terms of Epps is to be with that guy. You know?
Yeah, and I think Patsy, played by, and I'm going to butcher her name too, I'm sorry. Lupita Nyong'o.
I think it's Nyong'o. I think that's what we had voted on.
You voted?
our discussion at 100% Real is in Nyong'o, I think.
I'll go with that.
And I think...
you voted on it.
So, well, Lupita. Lupita.
Yeah,
But Patsy being in the picture, too, because Mistress Epps knows that Edwin is really into Patsy and, like, doting on her a bit and always praising her when she's picking 500 pounds of cotton every single day, that she realized she has jealousy towards Patsy, and then that's why she's also so cruel to Patsy as well. So that's another slave on the on their location there that also angers her.
My thing is, for Patsy, if she realizes the reason why Epps will not sell her is because, one, you know, he has feelings for her, but also, two, she picks a lot of damn cotton.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, I don't know why if she was so willing to die before when, you know, she asked Solomon to kill her, why wouldn't she just altogether just stop everything and get sold? If you don't pull your weight and pick your cotton, then wouldn't you eventually just get sold?
Well, I mean, I don't, or
I think
or
that's
hung,
easier
killed,
said than
killed,
done.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I know. But once you've lost all that hope, like, she lost all that hope, right? She was done. When you ask someone to kill you, then you don't care about anything anymore. So, in my mind, I'm just trying to think, just from the character perspective.
Because here's the thing, I think by being sold out, anything but death is a continuation, right? And especially, and it's also... Here is the hell you know versus if you get sold. Mm-hmm. God, you know, only imagine what hell you're going to be there, right? And
right.
That's what Solomon went through. He started off free. Then with Ford, he was kind of okay. Mm-hmm. And then he went to hell. And also, to me, it's interesting that throughout the movie, Solomon compares his despair to more women. Rather, we never really see him with men and how kind of, you know, in comparison to that he is. Right, the first woman, the one who lost her kids, she's crying and tells
Eliza.
Her to stop. Yeah, he tells her to stop. And, you know, and then the second version of that is Patsy. And but I would have also been interested to see kind of in comparison to what the men were going through.
Yeah, yeah. And we get a little bit at the very beginning when Solomon first gets sold into slavery. He's mm-hmm. with men, but they didn't last long. And now throughout the whole movie, he's mostly with women. And
but again, too, you know, take that a step further. You know, it was man or men who betrayed him. You know, everywhere he went, it was always a man or men mm-hmm. who sold him and, you know, drugged him, sold him, betrayed him. You know, mm-hmm. until we get to the end.
Also, but, a man that saved him.
Right. Mm-hmm. But up to that point, it was, you know, it was of the male kept on just screwing him over every single way, yeah. You know.
And Phil, you had mentioned Eliza a bit, played by Adepero? Adepero?
I'm really sorry, I'm butchering all these names.
But Eliza, she cried a lot in this movie, mm-hmm. and I can understand being ripped away from your children. And she cried a lot, and it bothered me. But then when I had listened to the 12 Years of Slave mm-hmm. book after this movie, I understood why she cried so much. Mm-hmm. Because Eliza, she had actually, or her and her children have actually already been in slavery for years. Mm-hmm. And she was promised that she was going to get free papers for her and her children on that very day that mm-hmm. Solomon went with her. So on the day that she was promised to get her free papers, she was sold back into slavery. Mm-hmm. And then she was ripped away from her children. So all that crying just made it all the more sense why she was so devastated for so long.
You know, it's fascinating you say that. I would wonder why the writer wouldn't just put in a throwaway line that says, you know,
I was supposed to be free today.
You don't understand. Yeah. I was supposed to be free today. I mean, I guess, you know, listen, kids being taken away for a mother, I can only imagine, was harrowing. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, I just went under the assumption that she was a free woman to begin with, yeah. and having everything. But, you know, I didn't.
She was already a slave, supposed mm-hmm. to be gaining her freedom that day, yeah. but sold back into slavery.
That's fascinating. That adds so much more to the character.
I think maybe they let it sit there for a little bit, mostly because that's what they do a lot of in this film, is they let you sit with an uncomfortable right. scene for a while, is maybe to kind of express that freedom for Black people back then, where it's just so in the wind. It just mm. could be given, it could be taken. It was just one day you have it, one day you don't.
It was a privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it wasn't and right.
Like before you were saying about John Ridley, like he wanted you to walk out of there feeling a certain way. Right. He wanted filmgoers nowadays to know what it was like to actually have your freedoms stripped from sure. you, as opposed to what a lot of people nowadays are complaining about.
Yeah.
I think I remember reading about that. That's what he.
And also, you know, for with that one, for me, one of the reasons why it's not used is because then you're getting a separation of free Black. Black people versus slaves. Mm-hmm. And I feel one of the nice things that the movie did really well was kind of keep it universal to, as much as it is Solomon's story, it was kind of a universal story. And if you get into some of those specifics, then, you know, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but I will. You know, if you're as an white audience member, there's the separation of, from, you know, you're looking at it and you're like, okay, well, eventually he's going to be free, but what about all these other Black slaves? They're not going to be free. And so mm-hmm. it's just one person that's gotten out of this, and congratulations to him, but there's a greater issue here.
Yeah.
And so I felt they made very specific choices to the movie to make sure that overall it was universal and you felt bad for the full condition rather than just Solomon.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, yeah. absolutely.
I feel for all of them because we saw a little snippet here and there how each of them were treated. Absolutely.
I was just, again, my thing is, if that was, you know, in the book, so we have to take it to be true. And, you know, it could have just been a throwaway line, mm-hmm. like, you know, because it makes her story, again, freedom is such a big word that, you know, it makes her story even that more tragic. Mm-hmm. It's tragic already, but to be put back into it, to be lied, deceit, and to be put back into it with her children when she's almost at, let's say, that finish line, mm-hmm. and then to be brought back in, then you really understand. I mean, the pain, like, Yeah, you can understand it, and you just would feel, I don't know. It worked the way it is. I was just curious, like, mm-hmm. if they knew that, maybe it's a deleted scene or something.
Yeah, and that's the thing that bothered me, because it just goes to show that freedom is something you can just dish out to people that if you want, and then you can tease it to people. Oh, I'm going to give you freedom. Oh, no, I'm not. Yeah. And that's what really bothered me and made me feel more for Eliza after I had known the fact. That's the little interesting thing I thought about Eliza. But and we also get, and we'll talk more about the scenes, of course, too, but still going off with the staff, a little bit of Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Near the end. He was a producer for this movie, mm-hmm. so I think he had to get his acting credit also mm-hmm. as Bass. What was his name? Samuel Bass. He plays the... He was an abolitionist.
He's Canadian abolitionist.
Yeah, from Canada.
And at first,
so he was very, very kind and nice and proper.
So my question to you guys, were you disrupted by Brad Pitt's appearance cameo in this movie? Did it bother you? Did you like it?
It did bother me, I'll be honest. I mean...
Why?
Just because... It's kind of just throwing a big name mm-hmm. into this hodgepodge of, like, other actors that kind of just it's a distraction of sorts. Yeah. Especially knowing that he was a producer on it. It's kind of like, oh, you could have gotten another, you know, lesser-known actor to do it. And also, too, I just have problems with Brad Pitt's acting in general.
Okay.
So, but I mean... I don't know. I liked what his character had to say.
Yeah.
But it. I just wish it would have been another actor. Just, you know, I don't know.
Fair enough.
Distracting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, personally for me, I thought it was... it didn't bother me. I knew going in that he was going to be in it. You know, and I don't think he was doing it as a... Again, I don't think he was doing it as, like, a vanity project. I don't think he was... No. Like, he's not going to be given... Like... His capacity come award season will be a producer. So if it were to get Best Picture, mm-hmm. you know, he gets an Academy Award, but he's not going to get it for his acting chops.
Yeah, because he's only in it for 5 minutes.
And, you know, that character, he was a great character.
Mm-hmm.
Very important character. Yeah. And, you know, and again, that relationship, because Solomon had been screwed over so many times mm-hmm. by different other men. He, you know, you saw the trepidation, and I don't know if I can tell you this because, you know, you could screw me over too. And, you know, I think that having a character that truly was nice and kind and meant and stood behind his words and mm-hmm. being that he was an abolitionist, he's from Canada, and the mere fact that he was able to stand up to Epps. You know, mm-hmm. I was actually sort of kind of nervous. I thought Epps was going to come back and fire him and then kill him.
See, and
for back talking to him on his property.
Mm-hmm. The thing, I didn't mind Brad Pitt being in this movie. I knew he was going to make a cameo, and mm-hmm. I'm glad it was at the very last minute because so much had already happened. Like mm-hmm. all the gruesome stuff has already been done and passed. Mm-hmm. And then seeing Brad Pitt, it was like that sigh of relief, like, oh, there's hope. Again, mm-hmm. and the person that he portrayed, Bass, we knew that he was helping in the liberation of Solomon, and I liked him. And the thing about Brad Pitt is that the character that he tends to play, they're always like things you want to talk about, mm-hmm. and he's the guy that you want to talk about because he helped in saving. Pretty much the movie mm-hmm. and the saving the character in the movie and like just putting that nice tie on at that little bow at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and he has that, you know, sort of kind of oh shucks charm, mm-hmm. you know, of the, you know, of that, of the country and the carpenter. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the mere fact that that character Bass stood up to Epps when they had that heated conversation mm-hmm. about property. That, you know, that was a, to me, that was
that
a
actually
really
happened
great scene.
Too.
Yeah.
In the book, Solomon said that he was kind of eavesdropping a little bit on that conversation, even mm-hmm. though he was still in the vicinity, but it got heated. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, Bass was a free man And he was a very strong liberal man who had opinions and whatnot. But because he was free, you know, Edwin Epps couldn't do anything about right. it. Like he
could have killed him.
Yeah, he
with
had
no consequence. No,
he had his right to say whatever he felt. Yeah. And there was a line where Bass said, "I have the freedom to leave whenever I want." Mm-hmm. And that was really true because mm-hmm. that's something we don't think of. I mean, yeah. we as citizens here in, you know, in America, we have the freedom to do whatever we want. And but them as slaves, they don't have that freedom, which was made it really kind of settle and it really hit the nail on the head for me.
Yeah.
Well, hearing that dialogue when I was listening to it, I was like, oh, wow, this is very, it's beautiful. It's almost like melodic in the actual words that were chosen. And they're word for word almost what Solomon wrote of the actual conversation in the book.
Yep.
Which is great. Which is, you know, listen, I haven't read the book. You know, but going by what I've learned, you know, it seems to be a faithful adaptation. Mm. Would you agree? I mean, would you?
I agree because I had listened to this book, and of course, there were more situations that happened on that you can't fit into a 2-hour long movie.
Right.
But it was every scene that has happened in this movie happened in the book. Yeah. So it's not like they added anything too extravagant to change the storyline or the pacing of the movie, but it all really was very kind of true to the book. So, let's talk about the direction and the cinematography. I thought this movie was very, very well shot.
Oh, beautiful. As far as catching the landscape. You know, I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't think whipping people is beautiful, but the way that it was shot, you know, it did. It was at times it was lyrical the way there were Phil, I was actually thinking you, a lot of close-ups,
yeah. but they worked. And, you know, and especially you really got close-ups when things were at their happiest and things when they were at the saddest, right? We talked about the scene where he's been, you know, kind of hanging. We have his feet for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
But then also opposite that, we have him with his violin a lot of times, right? And, you know, he's always adjusting, making sure it's in tune. Mm-hmm. And eventually that becomes a motif until right at the end where he's doing it and the string breaks.
Right.
You know what I mean? And very symbolic then, you know, 2 seconds later, the whole violin's on the ground.
Yeah. And more so on the close-ups, I noticed they had a lot of close-ups on, like, inanimate objects. Mm-hmm. Not so much people, even though we got the feet, but things that, there was the close-up of that insect on that plant.
Oh, right.
And then there was close-up of water on the steamboat and that mill that was going on. So all these little small inanimate objects that... And even the landscape that they were in when they were outside, there was a lot of sunsets and stuff. So it goes to show that even though visually they're in a beautiful place, yes, it was hot and whatnot, but stunning visual locations.
It contradicts what's going
on. It contradicts the cruel humanity that's going on in the environment.
Yeah. And, you know, there was another close-up, again, that I thought was so striking, and it was of Solomon. It's towards the end of the movie. It was of Solomon, close up of his face, and then the blue sky, and it just stayed on him, and the range of emotions going through his face. And I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but it could have been at that time where, you know, he's close to breaking, and it was just this amazing shot that just held on for a long time. And again, it was one of those things where we as moviegoers, I think today, we're primed and we're conditioned to fast edits. We've talked about this on Anatomy of a Movie before. So when shots are held, you know, a lot can be said without there being words, you know, without words said. And even Steve McQueen says, you know, sometimes dialogue isn't necessary. You know, you can say a lot more in one shot than you can say in 7 shots. Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of economics of filmmaking. And And it's so true. And you sort of kind of wish.
I'll add to that.
Yeah.
Only because, okay, so you're holding a shot, right? But there's so much going on in the background, foreground, every which way. And to me, it almost played with the audience in the sense that, you know, we're focused on something we don't want to be focused on. And you're like, but focus on the thing that I want to focus on, but you're not. You know, so it's making it very conscious of what it is that you should be watching because it's not in focus and that's what you want to see.
Right.
Yeah.
And three particular shots I want to talk about. The first shot is when Solomon is in the cell at the very beginning. He's just getting thrown in back into slavery. And after he's been whipped by the paddle there and he goes to the window, you only see his head. And because in the cell, we have no visual interpretation where he's at. We just know he's in the small solitary confinement. Yeah. But then they take it from the chef from the window up into, and he's yelling out for help. And it goes to that wide shot of like the city in the background.
It's the capital.
It's Washington D.C. But he's calling out for help, and no one's going to hear him. And that part was really effective. I thought so well done. It was just a simple crane shot out to the whole city. And then the second one I want to talk about is the close up of the paper when he's burning the paper after Edwin found out that he might be sending a letter, and he burns it to kind of save his life. And it lasted so long to the point where literally all the cinders went out to complete blackness, the loss of all hope. And I completely forgot the third one. I'm sorry. But
well, while you're thinking of it, no, because going back to what McQueen's whole thing is, you know, again, another thing when we talk about economics, the movie was shot in 35 days. Which by today's standards, that's a short production.
Especially for a period.
Right.
A period film.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and again, his confidence in his actors, you know, saying, you know, Chewie could express so much without saying a word and holding a close-up like we're talking. He's like the hope, you know, Steve McQueen's hope is that you can take that home with you and you'll think about it later. And to me, this is what the movie sunk in more for me after I left the theater than as I was watching the movie. And it was a movie that stayed with me. And, you know, the shots that you talked about were amazing. How about you? What were some of your sequences or shots that stayed with you?
Well, like there's the part that you talked about earlier with Tibbetts was singing a song and just the shot of the other slaves like looking at this, and then they kind of focused in on Solomon and his reaction in his eyes. Mm-hmm. You could see like he still couldn't believe this was actually happening. It was so far removed from anything that was possible in his life. That's just one scene, but I don't mean to get off topic, but what you were talking about the silence, I find is an incredible gift, I think, as an actor to get the freedom to live in a moment and to let those moments happen. And I think that was the reason why these performances were so great.
Yeah.
Because you really, like, it was just no effort, no forcing, completely wonderful. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I remember the last shot that when Solomon.
I knew it. It worked.
Yes, thank you.
I love it when a plan comes together.
Thank you for that. when Solomon had just talked to Bass. Mm-hmm. And talked about like sending that letter out. There was that one shot of him that was on him for maybe a minute long that he's just standing there looking around. And I thought that was so effective because it's so real time. And he finally got that little ounce of hope back. And now he's kind of looking at the world a little bit differently because realizing that he could leave, he could get out. Was more effective.
Yeah, I have a feeling that that seems like, that was a great shot. And again, I'll go back to the scene that I already talked about was the scene between Epps and Solomon. You know, Epps has his hand around him and he's like, so you're writing letters, I hear. and then he goes, so are you lying to me? And he just stares at him and the shot just goes on. And, you know, he had already, Solomon had already pleaded his case.
That because awkward I'm silence.
You, yeah. That awkward silence. And
this movie lives in awkward silence.
Yeah. Yeah. It's.
And lives on long shots, too. Mm-hmm. There were so many long shots and scenes that just lasted a good minute, good 2 minutes. In, mm-hmm. And I gotta, we can't, definitely can't forget the passy whipping scene.
Yeah. I was gonna say we have to talk about the whipping scene.
We have to talk about it. The whole Patsy. But you're saying that was hard to watch, mm-hmm. but the truth and all that happening and what even made it happen in the first place that she just wanted to get a bar of soap to clean mm-hmm. herself. And that's what makes it so sad. Something so simple caused something so horrendous to happen. Yeah.
And the way that was shot too, you know, it just, to me, it just brought up, you know, because we talked about Gravity earlier, and Alfonso Cuarón's gift for taking a long shot and moving a camera, that whipping scene was very similar, you know, and I noticed it seemed there were no real, there wasn't a cut, no. So to speak.
It was beautifully shot. Mm-hmm. The whole blocking of going from
right.
Solomon to Epps back to Patsy and going around the whole,
yeah.
the pole there. It was beautifully, like, in one smooth motion, even though right. it was so
and
jarring.
What, the other thing that I really found jarring about that, because I didn't necessarily feel that Solomon, he was holding his punches, so to speak, but you didn't realize to how much he was holding his punches until Epps got that whip. Because it goes around when Solomon's doing it, and she's in pain, obviously. And, you know, she's got some welt, but then when Epps takes over, there's that shot where it goes from Epps, she's getting whipped, but then it comes from the camera is behind Patsy, so you're mm-hmm. seeing Epps, Patsy are in your frame, and then the spray of blood. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was like, then it was so horrendous. And again, you talk about this movie is filled with uncomfortable moments. Mm-hmm. You're like, yeah, it's a contradiction. It was an incredibly shot scene, you know, from a technical standpoint, mm-hmm. from a technique standpoint. And again, Steve McQueen got everything he wanted out of that shot. And it was technically perfect. You know, you yes. can't call it beautiful, but from a technical standpoint, mm-hmm. it really, the way that he moved the camera, he got the desired effect.
Yeah, and even the effect of the skin literally getting flayed mm-hmm. off the body, that was hard to watch. Mm-hmm. I had to close my eyes for a second there. I was like, I can't believe that.
It's tough.
That it's so real because that happened not to everyone, like not to just to Patsy, but to everyone. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she, Epps made her literally strip down to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even more humiliating. And then getting whipped in front of everyone, that's just so it was so heart-wrenching.
Lupita said that actually of that scene, it was, I don't want to use the word easy, but it was, she was able to get to that emotional vulnerability because it wasn't a closed set.
So, okay.
You know, she's being, you use that feeling of being uncomfortable and upset about the fact that you're naked in front of all these strangers, and then you channel into that character and, you know. Good for her.
You know, well,
yeah. Very uncomfortable scene to shoot.
Yeah, no, it is. And I'm, you know, my curiosity as you know, loving cinema, and you know, is how was it shot? Like how, mm-hmm. like did she hint upon, you know, because we mm-hmm. okay, as filmgoers, you know, she wasn't being, you know, the actress wasn't being whipped. And so
I
was just
so
wondering
real.
What the movie magic was to have. You know, I was curious as to how it was choreographed.
Yeah.
And how she, you know, with Steve McQueen going like, okay, you know, you're getting hit now. And it's mm-hmm. doing like, I just wonder if that was part of the direction. You know, there were shots like that. You just, you know, he was, again, we love to talk on this show about craft and technique, and Steve mm-hmm. McQueen's craft and technique in this movie were really, They work to his desired effect, I think.
And
quite well.
Here's what I'm going to add about production, because, you know, so oftentimes it doesn't always get said, but especially with a movie like this, you know, in terms of making the set very actor friendly, You have to be able to do that, and you have to make everyone comfortable because, you know, if you have a production assistant walking, you know, any one of these actors to set, and anything can throw them off, you know, and it's not the actor being a diva or anything of that nature. It's that it's such a complex character, no matter who it is that you're playing, that you have to be in that moment. And so you could literally be like, hey, do you want a coffee? And it could just throw off the whole day, given that fact. And so, you know, at the speed of shooting only for 35 days and to accomplish what they did, you know, it must have been a really, really tight crew that understood what they were doing.
Yeah, and to get on to that emotional level. And another interesting thing about this whipping scene is that he had Solomon whip her first, and which actually did happen. But in the book, I found out that throughout the years in his slavery with Epps, that Solomon had been given many different duties, and one of them was he was a drover, and he had to move livestock, and he actually built the ability to handle a whip without actually hitting anything. It gave the effect that he was really using it, and looks like he's making contact with whatever he's doing, but it was with such grace that he wasn't hitting anyone. Mm-hmm. And then up until this point, when he was whipping Patsy, he used that talent to make it look like he was whipping Patsy. But overall, you know, Epps took over and like really caused the pain. But Solomon tried his best not to hurt Patsy.
Yeah. Now, see, again, I'm going to take this the other way from what I said before. I'm sort of glad I didn't know that, because then I truly would have said obviously he's holding his punches, but mm-hmm. I felt, yes, he's probably not going, you know, I don't know how adept he is as a whip. I felt that he was hitting her because she was, you know, she was making
the sound.
It
looked like
it,
too.
And it looked like she was getting hit, you know, with the whip. So, you know, I'm sort of glad that I didn't know that going into it, because it just added to the scene, and it added to the ferocity of what Epps did. I mean, because that was just, that was... And primal ferocity.
The tough part, you know, she was making noises as if she was getting hit, but, you know, obviously, I don't know the pain of which the impact, you know, was making upon her, but I always, for me, I wonder, you know, how do you even dare make that contact to know, like, hey, you know what, let's quote-unquote role play this. You know what I mean? In the worst term in the world, but as a, you know, to say like, hey, you know
they
what?
Have to,
I know I have to do this, but guess what? I'm going to do it, but just, you know, it's not going to be as harsh, but you got to do your part.
Yeah.
But I thought that was, yes, it added a whole different perspective to the scene, but I thought it made it more interesting, even though, because we see Solomon and Patsy, they build this relationship before this whipping scene, and then when of Solomon's forced to do it, Patsy says, I'd rather it be you. And so it just made it even more deeper and more emotional.
Yeah. You know, which actually, I wanted to go back, because you say, you know, with between Patsy and Solomon, Patsy asks Solomon to kill her. Mm-hmm. You know, so
it happened several times throughout the years.
But what's what I found interesting, sort of kind of interesting, is I sort of, when you're asking somebody else, like, it wasn't like there weren't the tools on that plantation for her to do that herself. Like, you know, she could have maybe sliced her wrists or have done something. To ask somebody else to do it, and again, I'm not a psychologist, but it almost seems that, you know, I mean, maybe one could argue that, you know, she wanted somebody to argue against her being killed in one way. Because if you're asking somebody to do it, that's a very tall order to ask of anybody. And it wasn't like she wasn't able to do it on her own. And so
I think for that one, it came from a religious standpoint.
Okay.
Because
that makes sense.
Because Solomon, she was like to Solomon, oh, you're not going to go to hell. God will know that you were doing it to save a soul or something like that. I think it was completely religious.
Yeah, because had she done it herself, obviously the reference is, you know, you go to hell if you commit suicide.
And
goes to show how religious I am.
Yeah, no, and I love the fact that you did bring up religion, because when I thought the thing that was interesting is every time Benedict Cumberbatch, his character,
Ford,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Every time Ford read scripture and everything, we'd always hear the audio from the previous scene underlying, still going on.
Right.
And you can't really tell what Ford's saying throughout the scripture. So it messes up the religion and the real acts that are going on. And it really blurred that line. And then when it went to Epps, that we could clearly hear what he's saying. But it doesn't. But it kind of felt like he didn't mean it. He was saying scripture, but he didn't mean it.
Yeah, I don't think they understood what scripture is, because again, it's that contrast.
It was really blurred.
You know,
and it still is very blurred. Like,
I mean, for Epps,
in real life, it's blurred.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
People spout scripture and don't really know the meaning of it.
Trust me, there's another
movie. Epps took it literally. He said there was that one passage that stripes, all those, right, the certain number of 100 stripes and whatnot. He took it literally.
Yeah.
He's like, that's scripture. If it says it in the Bible, then it's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really kind of interesting how they touched upon
to
that.
To me, there's nothing more fearful than a character who hides behind religion.
Oh, like, I agree.
To justify their actions and their violence and their evil. That's just because faith, I think, is so strong. It can really allow you to do anything you want to do. And it's terrifying because those kinds of people don't wane. They don't change their minds.
And you can't fight crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. you're right. And they are very fearful people mm-hmm. out there. And, you know, I saw another movie that dealt with something similar called Philomena, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's, yes, religion and standing by or hiding behind religion to make your right as might kind of, you know, stance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, it's very frightening.
Yeah.
And when you look at Epps, too, that character, come on. You know, mm-hmm. if you're really reading the scripture and you're taking it literally, mm-hmm. how can you be treating people this way? Yeah, again, another one of those contradictions that movie brings up.
I remember there was a quote. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no worries. Go ahead, say your quote. I just wanted to announce that we have Ebony K. Williams coming in. We know Siobhan has given up
hey,
a lot
Ebony.
Of her time, and she has to get going. So we're going to do it.
Well, before Siobhan leaves, I want to ask a quick question, because one thing we haven't discussed yet. What are your, you know, well, number one, thank you for coming on board, and thanks for being a guest host. A pleasure to meet you. tell us again. We didn't get to talk about how we felt about the movie. Mm-hmm. So how did you, your thoughts on the movie as a whole?
My thoughts on the movie is I originally didn't want to see this movie, to be honest. It's just something that I was like, oh, I know exactly what this is going to be. It's not because I didn't know of course it was going to be good, but because it would be hard for me to watch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad I did it. It was exhausting. It was tiring, but it was, I'm glad I did it.
And it opened your eyes.
It opened my eyes, and it's the story that needs to be told. It's a story that needs to be seen and talked about. I'm very grateful that this movie has been made in my, you know, time when I'm able to see it and appreciate it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
And we appreciate your time here.
One last quick question. Where can the people find you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Siobhan_Hughes. Also, my website, SiobhanHughes.com. I also do the after show for Bad Girls Club on AfterBuzz TV. And 100% Real. On Black Hollywood Live.
Yes, another great film podcast you should definitely take a listen to. Thank you so much,
Siobhan. All right,
thank you, guys. Siobhan, it was a pleasure.
All right, and while we're switching out, we're also having another lovely panelist join us,
hey,
Ebony
there.
Williams. Welcome, Ebony.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Hello.
How are you?
Great.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. My pleasure. And to very important film to talk about.
So. Yeah, so we agree that we've touched a lot of the main focus scenes. We just wrapped up pretty much the whole whipping scene with Patsy. And what were your quick thoughts of this overall movie so far?
Oh gosh, a lot of thoughts. I come from a background, by the way. One of my majors in undergrad was African and African American history and studies. So I've studied this time period and genre extensively. I was very excited to hear that this film was being made. I don't think that this country takes its history concerning slavery seriously, particularly millennials. and the, in our generation, it's something that collectively we carry a lot of misunderstanding and shame about. And I'll get to that in a deeper into our analysis. But I was very happy to go see the film. Of course, very difficult scene for anyone to watch. The entire movie was difficult to watch at times.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the story of Solomon is the story of the will to survive. And he mm-hmm. talks about that from start to finish. And even in the last scene, it's not as if this is some happy ending. And that was the thing I cautioned people about. When you go see this movie, and do understand you need to go see this movie, sure. but do not go with the expectation of some happy payoff at the end. It's not like Django. It's not like some other films we've seen made, or even to that degree, Amistad, where you mm-hmm. leave the film feeling as if the journey was somehow worth it. Mm-hmm. It's never worth it. And this yeah. film doesn't provide that either.
Yeah, no, I mean I agree with you. The ending for me, I looked at it, you know, again from a, you know, a little bit, you know, the psychology of it all is he comes back and he apologizes yeah, to yeah. his family.
That's what I thought was.
And cool. that is what that impacted me the most. Like, I'm sorry, and. Mm-hmm. He didn't do anything wrong. And mm-hmm. There were title cards that came up prior to the credit roll, saying, you know, he took this to court.
Yes.
He lost every single wow. time. But I think to me, the most powerful thing at the end, you know, was him apologizing to his family and then knowing that nobody knew how, when, where, or why he passed on. Like, yeah. it was a yeah. mystery. And today, it still we is still a mystery yeah, as to what happened. So you sort of kind of know that, and of course you would understand that it, you don't know how much farther the family life continued. Yes. And mm-hmm. it probably was not.
Well, we know Solomon, after he was he regained his freedom, he went to court, but sure. he also talked about the slavery, and he talked.
He was a huge abolitionist. Yeah. Yes, he
was very active,
and he helped with the Underground Railroad
and sure. liberation yeah. and all that.
But for him to pass away, yeah. You know, and on all accounts, like a wife didn't know, something happened. Something further happened there.
And there are many theories
and,
out there, too.
Yeah, and to me, that was very fascinating. One other thing about Steve McQueen that I had found out, that he had descendants mm-hmm. that were slaves from the Caribbean. And that's another reason why he felt that it was important to make this movie, but he wanted to take that different track, as we talked about earlier. He didn't want to go from... You know, born into, he felt it more interesting if you take a free man and, you know.
Because it's a different psychology behind
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. And I, to your point, Dimitri, very important to me, the most pivotal moment is when he says, I'm sorry. Because mm-hmm. again, going back, it is that notion of shame. Why? Because you, like you said, he did nothing wrong in his mind and in his yeah. psyche, and still to this day in the psyche of many Black Americans in this country who are descendants of slaves. That's where the shame is rooted. What did we do to make ourselves so vulnerable that mm-hmm. we could be enslaved? You see what I'm saying? And that's a really deep disconnect that many people struggle with. And that's the root of why it's so difficult to even have these conversations and have these films get to production in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. That inherent belief that was literally beaten into them by submission mm-hmm. that they're in the wrong and that the white Caucasian people were in the right.
Yeah, and they could, again, McQueen in interviews has said that, you know, another interesting fact was that prior to 1841, when this went down, you know, in 1811, before Solomon even got to the plantation and whatnot, you know, a lot of, there was revolt on the plantations sure. and mm-hmm. they were really, you know, put down, and it says, and he goes on, like 100 slaves from this revolt on the plantations, like they were just killed, and then their bodies were shown as examples. Mm-hmm. And again, I said it at the top of the show, you know, as a species, we can really suck sometimes.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's, and you know, and this movie exemplifies it. And we were talking earlier too about things have changed, but they're, a lot hasn't. Human trafficking today is still...
Here's what I want to say to that point, only because you brought up Schindler's List and, you know, Holocaust and things like that. And the problem becomes, you know, you speak of these things and it almost seems like an anomaly. Everyone wants to chalk it up to that. But the fact is there's tons of Holocaust going on today, mm-hmm. you know, just not with Nazis and Jews per se. But, and then obviously we're talking about this movie at length about that. And so people are too quick to write that off as like, oh, that would never happen. But you know what? Evil is just an extension of otherwise good morals, and I think that's what people really need to get. You know, we talked about, you know, the religion thing, and that's where people are justifying, oh, well, you know, I can hide behind religion because in the strict scripture and things like that. And that's why this movie for me is really important to talk about and for people to see, is because of that fact, and not to be like, oh, well, that happened, you know, hundreds of years ago. No, that's still happening in various forms today.
Well, I'll take it just like one quick step further. You know, the other thing that was going through my head is, what is the age limit? Like, you know, is junior high? Personally, I think that the field trips for kids should be, especially if you're a history teacher.
I would say high school.
High school? You know, to
wait,
see.
Why so old, guys?
Well, I always,
first of all, the violence, of course, and this is a rated R movie, and the nudity within it. I feel, because it's such an intense movie,
I feel like
adult teenagers, if you're from like the 14 age up, would understand it rather than grade school, and you know, the middle school age.
I don't know, because again, I was like, this to me would be a much more important field trip to the movies than, you know, taking the class to Hunger Games. You know, only, you know, I believe this is a part of our history, and to your point where you were saying, yeah, we are somewhat ashamed of it, and yes, absolutely, but from a learning perspective, you know, when I was a kid, when I was, you know, a hell of a lot younger, and I could have been in grade school, I'd have to check out the years. I mean, there was a very, very big event. Like, this is when TV only had three networks, mm-hmm. and you had VHS and UHF. The big thing was the miniseries, and Roots was mm-hmm. like the big miniseries of the time. And I was young, but I was through school, through my parents, you know, we watched Roots, and I was young at the time. And yes, it doesn't compare to what we have today in 12 Years a Slave, but I was thinking, you know, why not have middle school or, you know, freshman type classes go to this? I know when Schindler's List came out, there was a huge school program, even though that movie was rated R, you know, it was the movie to see because it depicted history in such a way.
Stories.
And, yes. And I, you know, what age do you think?
Oh, I think sixth grade and above. I mean, I agree, it's really graphic and it's rated R, but the thing is, we've got to start integrating these cultural stories at a very early, as early as we can, because like mm-hmm. you said, Schindler's List for sure. But then even the book, then maybe if this is too much for elementary or late high school, late middle school students to see the film, at least sign the book. Because
I
know
reading.
We, you know, of course we all read Night sitting at this table, I'm sure, mm-hmm. or something like it, to familiarize yourself with the story of the Holocaust and the horror associated with it, so we can have a better place of understanding. And that just has to happen, for all of us as Americans, but also again, particularly for the Black American consciousness in this country, you guys. We are all ashamed of slavery, but I can speak to the perspective of a lot of people in the Black community. We have a particular shame associated. Again, not that it was our fault, but we don't, many of us don't, and I don't fully understand how this happened to us. And like Phil said, this could happen today under the right set of circumstances to several mm-hmm. different cultural groups in this country. We know it still happens to women. It certainly happens to children. So we just really have to get to a deeper level of understanding about these things before we can be secure in that it won't happen again in this way.
Right. I agree. I think for the book, definitely middle school age, like you said, because even in middle school, we're reading The Diary of Anne Frank,
absolutely.
Which it has this exact same thematic themes throughout it. But for the film, as a film, I think you should watch it while you're older, while you're old enough to comprehend what's the severity of what's going on.
Sure. Mm. You know, it's going to your point in doing my research. I found a thesis from this gentleman. It's from the university. He's PhD associate professor of history at University of Miami. The gentleman's name is Edmund Apke. Mm-hmm. And he was writing about 12 Years a Slave. And he goes on to say that the movie may be the instigator for cultural conversation about a chapter in history that is still not yet fully explored in high school history classes. Mm-hmm. Because it is too unpleasant, ugly, and too shameful to remember that this was once the face of America. You know, he goes, and that sentiment is alive and well. It happened so long ago. He goes, you know, that now we have a black president. Why should we even worry about that? Well, let's get over it. But the slavery era is deeply woven into the fabric of African-American experience. The resilience of the people who survived and resisted and forged new identities and cultures and music is extraordinary. The violence is on one side of it, but another side is the complexity of the individual. Some slaves killed themselves so they didn't have to suffer. Some struggled through it to provide for their families. Fathers did whatever they could to protect their children. That complexity is often lost when you focus too much on the horror and the brutality. People preserve their lives despite these incredible challenges. And in the long run, they thrived. And the lack of neat resolution, yeah. What we talked about in 12 Years a Slave, no resounding triumph over villains gives the film a haunting power that connects it to present day.
Yes,
and again, what we just talked about, I find that, yeah, it's it resonates. And it's true. Yeah. It resonates. And I think, again, when you look at a Solomon, he can symbolize the everyman. Like, yeah. You don't, again, I don't want to be misunderstood, but because it is a part of American history, and, you know, I was born and raised in America, and, you know, to have this depersonalization, to be stripped of identity, yeah. You know, he does stand for, you know, the common man. And it, to me, it goes above, you know, race and color. I mean, this is just a horrible, atrocious thing.
It's also a love story too. I mean, a love story of a father's unrelentless love and commitment to his children and his family. And I think that's so important and powerful for us to see today, because we are currently living in an epidemic of times where more children and communities of color are born without their father than with. And generally, even if we open that up to include Caucasians, certainly no time in history have there ever been more fatherless children in this country.
Yeah.
And so it's important to see that that's not the norm. That's not the tradition of any of these cultures, that we are just at a new crisis point and we need to go back to the love and the commitment of men like Solomon. And that's really important.
Yes, and I was so happy that Solomon, he finally regained his freedom. And a little bit about his freedom, you know how he had Bass's help to write the letter and send it out, but in the movie it only took a small amount of time for him to regain that freedom after the conversation, but in reality it took months. Because he had Bass write and send the letter in August, I forget the exact year, I want to say 53, and then Solomon didn't regain his freedom till like January of the next year. So from summer to winter, he was still in slavery, and he didn't get a response till weeks later, because to send a letter took about 2 weeks, and to get a response back during that time, you know, we don't have email.
I mean, of course,
you don't have internet and
it's
all
Pony
that.
Express,
that literally, yeah.
instant gratification that we have nowadays, but so it took so long to get the word out and message, and then he developed this relationship with Bass, and Bass had promised him, he's like, well, I'm gonna do my best to save you, I promise I will help you regain your freedom. And he told Solomon that if you keep fighting to the spring, we'll get you out of here, we'll get you reconnected. And he had his family finally got the letter that he was sent out, and they found people to help. So I thought the story behind the freedom, we didn't really touch upon that in the movie, but the real life story that happened behind that and his freedom help.
What I like about that is that, you know, throughout this whole thing, he's trying to find one person to kind of connect with that is a white person who can help. And so, you know, while you have one person that can make life hell, it also takes one person to make change within any person's life. Mm-hmm. You know, and so while it's obviously not, while the victory within the movie is not great, it, you know, it doesn't help everybody. It's a small victory, and it's a message that you can take away.
Yeah, and you can help.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And we mentioned that like men were the reasons why he was into slavery, but it was man that helped him get out.
Right.
Yeah.
So and then and definitely the last scene when he's finally reunited with his family, his children all grown up. That's when I really got choked up at the end, and I just had to sit there and like absorb everything that just happened.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that this movie. Okay, so the title gives it away. It's 12 Years a Slave. So this is encapsulating 12 years. Mm-hmm. There wasn't, now, the, you know, I guess there could be many ways to go through this. And I don't know how it was in the book, you know, but the movie never gave us a time reference outside of 1841 and all the stuff on the plantation. There were some scenes where you saw him trying to notch things. But as an audience member, I never had... I just knew that this was a very long time period that it was going on. And I thought it was an interesting choice because sometimes in movies they'll put up a title card saying like year two, right? Year five, year eight, you know, this happened then and it chronicles this. But to me, I felt it more powerful that that didn't happen because I just knew that this was a very long period of time.
And it felt like a long period of time.
It felt a long period of time.
I didn't
need to know what year it was, so to speak.
Well, you could see the age in Solomon's face and just his physicality. It was just incredibly powerful. And if you guys touched on this, we can move on from it. But I wanted to speak a little bit about the role of the black female slave, particularly Patsy, but also the character played by Alfre Woodard, because it's a really nuanced conflict that you had to, and that for me watching this as a black woman, I kept imagining how I would handle that and what would be my rationale behind it. Because there's certain choices you can make as a slave woman that might make life more survivable for you. And at what expense and at what cost? And also, is it even really a choice? And how do you live from that? Actually, we saw this angst from this, remember when Solomon was first captured into slavery, the woman who was separated from her children.
Right.
Yes.
She talked about that to him and made that confession. And you could just see it was like the horror on her face. Like, I've done things, unspeakable things to, you know, be able to survive. And now for what? So it's
for nothing.
For nothing. And just the sheer horror associated with that was just something that I don't know. It just, I still don't know how I feel about it. But,
yeah, and I think the interesting, I'm glad you brought that up with Alfre Woodard, who played Mistress Harriet Shaw.
Yes.
She was a free woman who has class, who seems educated now, and she was like the ideal free black woman that Patsy
aspired to be.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely wanted to be.
Sure.
And I think it was, because she always wanted to go back to Harriet Shaw for those moments of comfort. Yeah. When she wasn't on the plantation, she was with Harriet.
Yeah.
And when I'm sure it was probably Harriet that told Patsy, like, you gotta keep yourself clean, you gotta you have that good hygiene, and that's why Patsy went back to Shaw to get that bar soap.
Yeah. Not understanding all the while that she was never in a position to end up being her anyway. And that's the extra tragic part about it.
Absolutely.
Yes. I did like how they did touch upon a little bit of the female perspective within the midst of the movie.
Yeah, really critical. I mean, I mean maybe I'm biased because I am a woman, but to me, her story was as compelling as Solomon's.
And it just goes to show, it's not just the men, it's not just Solomon's story.
Yeah.
It's also, this is a country nationwide problem that was going on during that time. It's not just, it was all genders that was,
you know, and taking it a step further, like, again, you know, since you mentioned Alfre Woodard's character, Mr. Shaw, I mean, that warrants a story to, how did you get in that position? What other sacrifice, or, you know, and that character is in the movie for a short time.
Yes.
5-7 minutes tops.
Not even.
But yet, it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And it says a lot. And to your point with Patsy, it's just, I mean, her character, you know, that the Alfre Woodard character, Mr. Shaw, could warrant a story if it were out there, if you know.
And she's honest. She's an honest version of that, because we've seen that kind of glamorized black mistress in the slavery era many times. Some would even say we saw it in Alexander's Queen, in the Judge. And people are very critical of that, with obvious reason, when you start to glamorize that role. But she's honest. You know, I've paid a price, a high price, to not be beaten, and it still is a horrible experience, but it's better than the alternative. Right. And I liked that it didn't over glamorize it in that way.
Yeah, and maybe question how Harriet was freed, and she was, I guess, she was married.
Yeah, I mean, and, as married as you could be interracially at that time.
Yeah. And that's what makes it interesting, because during the slave, women were treated horribly during that, and they were raped, and they were married and forced into marriage by so many masters. It made me question, did she marry someone out of force?
It made you question it, Marissa. Yeah, she did. Like, yeah,
she had to marry.
That was her only option.
Was it to save herself from like sexual prosecutions and all that?
Oh, so. I'm sure that, and the beatings. Because remember, she had that great line where, "Yeah, I haven't gotten whipped in so long," and she was so proud of that.
But they subtly touched upon that. I wish they would have made it a little bit more clear.
Yeah, because that's what I say. It's very nuanced.
Like, we know she's free, but what
did that journey look like?
And again, I just took it as she's only free to an extent.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, again, the word freedom.
But she married just to get out of prosecution.
And she felt lucky to do that. Absolutely. I mean, because there were so many slave women that were still at the hands of sexual persecution, still raped, I mean, on a nightly basis, we saw with Patsy. And they didn't walk around in you know, dresses and stuff like that and have servants and things of that nature. So Just a sad existence.
Yeah. Yes, and definitely. Let's talk a little bit, really quickly, about the music that was used. This Hans Zimmer, obviously.
Fantastic score.
I liked how it wasn't throughout the whole movie, because there were a lot of moments where there was just pure silence, and they used the silence really effectively. But then in some moments there, you can hear the undertone score of Hans Zimmer, and I can tell right off the bat it was Hans. Mm-hmm. It sounded really like Inception to me.
Yeah, really.
So, like his time score.
I'm going to throw it. I mean, I didn't realize it was Hans Zimmer until the end and when I saw the credits. And I was surprised because, well, there were a couple of scenes that were the score. It was like twofold. On one hand, it was very primal. And when it got primal, that really set a dark tone that you just knew something not so good was about to happen when it got that primal. And then he would turn again to what he did in Rush, where it was sort of kind of subtle. There wasn't anything to me, Hans Zimmer. I love Hans Zimmer as a composer, as a movie music guy. I think he's great. He does a lot. This year alone, I mean, God, he had Man of Steel, Lone Ranger, Rush, this movie. That's four movies he's composed for. Mm-hmm. So it's crazy. You know, he's crazy busy. But usually I associate him. He's very bombastic. He's very in your face. When you look at the Dark Knight scores, you look at Inception, he's loud. Man of Steel, he had over 12 percussionists. I mean, he can be very much in your face. Even Pirates of the Caribbean. And when he can do a Rush or even a 12 Years a Slave, and he can do the very primal and then go to subtle, I thought it was a very accomplished score for him. He's had a fantastic year, you know, and I thought that
and
the music did what it should do. It should help set a tone. It should never overtake a scene. It should only add an atmosphere and be some way
complimentary. Like complimentary. It wasn't competing with the dialogue in any
Complimentary is the perfect word. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I do admit there was one moment.
I exist, yeah.
I do.
Okay. I do admit there was one moment where it did take me out of the movie because I did realize it was Hans because it was so similar, but it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. What scene was that?
I can't remember it exactly off the top of my head, but I could tell it was Hans. Just all of his music, because I'm a big fan of Hans. I've listened to most of his music, so there was just that one moment. I was quickly taken out of the movie, but
Phil, what are your thoughts on score?
I didn't realize that it was Hans Zimmer, but there was definitely points when I was listening to it. I was like, this kind of sounds like the ending to Inception.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good with the soft piano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the violins that was going on.
But then, what I loved about it is you had such a mix of, you know, you had score, then you had Salman's violin, and then you had slave songs for, is it? You know, pardon if I don't know the term.
I'll say it for you, Phil. That's Negro spirituals.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. There you go. But can you speak? Because
actually, how could I forget that incredibly powerful scene at the burial of
yes, exactly.
Oh my God.
I have that in my
The use of Negro spirituals, incredibly significant, because just as much as the overseers and slave masters used religion to condone slavery, we as Black people, coming from African heritage and maybe Christianity not necessarily being our native religion, but to the extent we were exposed to it here, it became our only lifeline. And we held on to it with everything we had. So, yeah, certainly. And that's why the Negro spiritual in many churches across this country still persist in some way, shape, or form, because it is kind of that foundational root. And even modern jazz, modern R&B, you listen to Ray Charles, all of those influences date back to gospel, which indeed date back to the foundation of the Negro spiritual in that way.
So, and this, the particular burial scene, I found it in just the character-wise, when Solomon, because throughout the whole movie, we see everyone singing, but Solomon hasn't yet.
Right.
And this one, Solomon finally gives in and he starts singing. I felt that this point in the movie, he kind of accepts that he is a slave, just like everyone. He realizes his possible fate.
I think I'm half with you on that, Marissa. I think it was a moment of acceptance for him, but not necessarily that I'm now going to acquiesce to slavery in the way that I see these others. Maybe more so, I'm going to stop resisting the community that I am a part of in this way. So not necessarily embracing himself as a slave, but joining into the community around him and
like
understanding
solidarity.
That he, but I still agree. Seeing himself as separate and not buying into the slave mentality, but while still embracing the community, which was beautiful.
Yes, it was a very well done scene.
Absolutely.
So this movie, overall, it was beautifully executed, and it's coming upon award season now. Do you think with the actors and whatnot that they should get recognized for this type of movie?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, from a movie standpoint, as I talked about earlier, you know, what's amazing about this movie in particular is the momentum that it's gaining. It is, at this point, it's becoming a freight train, and it's going to be, you know, we're going into the award season. We're going into the holiday season, which is predominantly a big commercial movies. And this movie is going to continue to weave its path through the Ender's Game, through the Hunger Games, through, you know, all of these other big movies, you know, for entertainment purposes. And, you know, then it's got some other, you know, we still have like American Hustle, Wolf of Wall Street coming out. But this movie, because, and again, I'll bring this up to marketing. I think that, you know, they've done a fantastic job. They picked, it was very smart of them to go from late December to early October because they're able to build that swell. So come December 31st is what, you know, that's the last day for the year. Last time a movie can, you know, you have to open up your movie before that date in order to be considered. Right. This movie is building up such a swell already so that even though all these other big blockbusters are going to come out, 12 Years a Slave is going to continue to grow. It'll be continued to talk about. It'll be talked about in December. It'll be talked about in January.
It's, see, and the story with 12 Years a Slave is still relevant no matter what time of year you're watching it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
so,
that's the great thing about this movie. It's so timeless.
Yeah. And you know, so when it comes to Academy time, you know, I would be shocked if it wasn't up for things like Best Picture. I would be shocked if Chatwell didn't get Best Actor nomination, if Fassbender didn't get Best Supporting Actor, if Steve McQueen didn't get,
even Lupita,
you know,
breakout role. She's going to be working for the rest of her life.
Yeah,
now.
She's amazing. I have to say this though, this is interesting. First off, question for everybody, including you, Phil. Anybody on any of your social media timelines, Facebook or Twitter or anything, saying that they were not going to see the movie? Did you guys see any of that? No.
I haven't. I haven't read anything about people not
wanting to see it.
Yeah.
I always hear about the people who have seen it and then want to talk about
it. Okay, but nobody's saying I'm not going to see it.
Yeah, I haven't encountered it. In fact, I've encountered the opposite. I've encountered this seems to be the must see.
I'm really glad movie. You're saying that. Phil, same with you. No, you've not seen any opposition?
I hear a lot of people that were resistant to see it, but then did see it and love that they force themselves to watch it.
Okay, so I have not seen any non-black people resistant to seeing this movie. In fact, it's exactly what you just described. They've been very, not excited, but curious, intellectually stimulated, and motivated to go see the film. I have seen many in my community say that they have they are upset about the film. They don't want to go see it. And again, I think it goes, and this is surprising. Yeah, and that's why I just had to use this platform to speak about this because it goes back to this issue of shame. The narrative goes, I am tired of seeing films that depict us in a subservient way, whether it's The Help. And that's why I brought it up for this conversation, because there was a lot of backlash. You know, I thought Octavia Spencer was amazing in The Help. I also thought Viola Davis was, and all the actresses were. But there's a lot of backlash for why do we only get Academy recognition when we are in those types of roles? So all that to say, I wanted to know from you guys, and I wanted to share my opinion on it. I believe it's Chiwetel, the lead actor. How he doesn't at least get a nomination. And quite frankly, unless I'm blown away by something I haven't seen so far, he wins. But I know that he will receive backlash probably from the black community because, again, of course he gets it because he's playing a slave. Because of the ignorance of not understanding, he's not just playing a slave. He's telling the story of American survival and resilience and perseverance.
Yeah. To me, and I think this is what makes the movie above and beyond what you were saying.
Yes.
You know, to me, again, as I was watching it, I apologize for being repetitive, but new guest. Yeah. What I was saying, you know, I'm a huge movie fan and I love science fiction a lot. Mm-hmm. To me, this played almost like a bizarre Twilight Zone episode where you take an everyday man who has the normal life.
Normalcy.
He's got the family. Yes. He's got this. And then he's ripped away from that.
Yes.
He's thrown into the slavery. He's thrown into a world he's so unfamiliar with. And why am I here? Yes. And usually stories like in science fiction, usually very good science fiction always holds a mirror up to society. Mm-hmm. I found that this movie holds a mirror up to society even today, but it's not science fiction. It's true.
It's true.
I had to keep on reminding myself. Mm-hmm. This isn't a made up. This isn't a story. It is a true morality tale. Mm-hmm. It is a true story. And I had to keep reminding myself of that. And for all of those reasons, that's what made this movie. This isn't just a story about slavery.
No.
I think that Steve McQueen was right. His instincts were correct. He didn't want to make a slavery movie. Mm-hmm. It was best to see what happens when you are dehumanized. What happens when you're identity is stripped.
It's a story about identity.
It's identity.
It's a story about identity.
I have two questions for you guys. Well, one's a question, one's a point. first one being, how do you hold it up to the butler? Not in the sense of, you know, in comparison, but when you kind of, you know, as Ebony was speaking, you know, people getting honored, there's a lot of talk about the butler being a great movie and people deserving nominations for that. And, you know, so I think it's very much in keeping with the notion that Emily brought up, was why just these movies?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so also, how do you kind of, for lack of a better term, split the votes, you know, what, you know, in terms of like, okay, well, is the butler going to take certain things, whether nominations or awards, or does, you know, 12 Years a Slave?
See, and honestly, I haven't seen the butler yet.
The butler. Okay.
Do you see
but
the butler? I have not.
I have to give it to the black community that they are having these movies that are so important, that these are stories that probably would have never been told had someone had the perseverance to tell them and had the platform to show these movies. And I'm glad that they're finally coming out, because we, the people, we need to see these movies.
Did the butler have the same reaction?
Yes. A lot of people really, literally, I'm just quoting stuff I saw on Facebook, guys.
I'm so tired
of seeing, while we always have to be a maid, a slave, or a butler. That's a direct quote. So that's referencing The Help, 12 Years a Slave, and The Butler. But I understand the frustration. So don't get me twisted here. There is a desire for many in the black community to also see stories of Booker T. Washington, to see stories of Madam C.J. Walker, I was talking about on Boardwalk, to see stories of Blacks who are professionals, Blacks who have a story of prosperity in this country. And because those stories are out there, too, and they're also not being told. And, so,
well, there was the movie that just came out, like, I believe, recently, Red Tails 2, about the Tuskegee men.
Boo, girl, no. Yeah. No, I mean, but, good story, not well done.
Yeah,
I don't know
but,
if you saw it. It was poorly done. Yeah.
But still, having those kind of movies out, but it's showing the Black community in a positive light, though. Mostly.
Yeah. Oh, Red Tails?
Yeah.
No, true enough. But to Phil's point, how does it, I saw both. The Butler was a good film. I don't have anything negative to say about it, except for, to be honest, I was a bit disappointed by the film. I expected more of Lee Daniels, especially coming off of his work with Precious, and even his production of Monsters Ball, whether you liked the film or didn't. I expect him to push it to the edge.
Yeah.
And nothing about The Butler felt to the edge. In fact, I left the theater feeling, where is the soul-wrenching connectedness that I did feel in 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know,
you mentioned Monsters Ball, and I was with Lionsgate when we released that. Mm-hmm. And for us, it was a really big deal with Halle Berry winning that Academy Award. Mm-hmm. And, And being at that time, Lionsgate was a much different entity than it is today. So the mere fact that we got that movie recognized, that we got her recognized or helped get her recognized, and the mere fact that she won wasn't about, I mean, it was an amazing moment. So watching the Academy Awards, and again, when you talk about positive, and she was fantastic.
Her acceptance speech?
Yeah, of course. She's amazing.
But a lot of backlash. I mean, there are people to this day that will not even acknowledge her
double-edged
win.
Double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Well, also, you know, Kerry Washington, there was a huge debate about whether she should have gotten something at the Emmys for her, you know, role in Scandal.
Right.
And, you know, it's ironic enough that Siobhan actually, you know, our earlier guest kind of shed some light onto this. Yeah, she's doing a great job, and she's opening up the doors for Black actresses. But look at who she's portraying. The only she's sleeping with a white man on TV, and that's her claim to fame. You know what I mean? As a character,
that's the argument. That's going to always be the argument. I actually don't buy that personally, because here's the deal: it's a story, it's a fiction. Get over it. You know, if you don't like it, quite frankly, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I'm so sorry that there's not a special formula that is the perfect Black role for us to get acknowledged for. Kerry Washington's fantastic in the role. There's been other Black women who've slept with white men that aren't and shouldn't be nominated for a damn thing.
Sure.
And, you know, so that's just the way the cookie crumbles. But I've heard that too, Phil. I've heard that too.
But that's true. So I just hope that this movie does get the recognition it does deserve because it was really well done.
Yeah, and
if it doesn't get a nomination, then shame on Hollywood.
I think it'll get nominated for Best Picture. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how can it not? I mean, again.
Best director.
Absolutely. Yeah. So well, I'm sorry, Phil.
Let me ask you this, Dimitri, because you're so inside on the politics of all this. To a degree. Let me ask, because, okay, right, screeners are sent out, people go on family vacations, and they go through these, quote, not, you know, right before nominations happen, and, okay, what's a white family going to watch? Wolf of Wall Street, or 12 Years a Slave, you know?
You know, it's a great question. You know, the screener program, you know, for the Academy, It's a prestige thing. I think getting 12 years, you know, when that shows up in the mail, it's a prestige thing. You know, on the family vacation, it may not be the family vacation movie, like, hey, kids, let's sit down and watch 12 Years a Slave. But I do think it still will be watched via screener heavily because you won't be able to avoid it.
Turn away from it. Yeah,
you can't. And you're not going to, you know, to be a responsible Academy member, you know, how can you not? Now, I'm a big fan of going to the movie to make your judgments about this. You know, I feel, you know, 12 Years a Slave, yeah, it'll be a big quote unquote get when it comes time to screener time. But you're right. I mean, they're not going to show it during the family ski vacation in Aspen. But it will be watched. And I think, you know, dare I say, I think it'll probably be passed around a lot too. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be, it's not going to perpetuate the movie business, which I would much rather them go to the movies to see the movie, mm-hmm. but it will be, hey neighbor, I just saw this movie. And, you know, so, and again, when you talk about groundswell, this kind of talk that mm-hmm. we're having, mm-hmm. it's not unlike what everybody else who's seeing this movie is mm-hmm. having too. The movie forces this kind of a conversation, which I think for movies is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's why we do this show. Mm-hmm. So the screener program will perpetuate, hopefully, people to get out. And, you know, because the good word of mouth, and to the point of it's not a typical slave story. Really about, like, identity. What you're saying.
Very little. The percentage for the people who actually regain their freedom is so low.
Yeah. What do you think, Phil? Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it was a concern of mine that, you know, and I kind of just wanted your insight on it.
And I
hope, I mean, it's too important a film to not nominate. And honestly, if that's the reasoning that it doesn't, shame on everybody.
Well, yeah, shame
let's,
on
well, let's just say, let's take importance out of it. It's too good of a film.
It is good.
It's mm-hmm. too good of a film not to be nominated. Importance is one thing. We can be hand-fed and we can be, you know, spoonfuls of importance. That doesn't make a movie good. This happens to be a very good movie that happens to be a very important movie. So, you know, for those merits, they should judge it not because it's just important, but they should judge it because it is very good.
I agree.
Because
honestly, I don't expect many nominations for The Butler, to be honest with you. And I love Oprah Winfrey to death. We give her my kidney. but and same with Forrest Whitaker. He's honestly amazing. But it was an important movie, to your point, not, in my opinion, the best.
Yeah.
And honestly, because I still haven't seen The Butler, mm-hmm. but I think that's why The Butler was so big, because we had Oprah's name on
it. Mm-hmm. It helped.
It definitely helped.
That was Forrest Whitaker and Octavia Spencer, probably not the same reaction.
Yeah, it definitely helped, but because we had Brad Pitt in this movie, and you think it would do kind of the same thing, but no, mm-hmm. it didn't, and it didn't need it.
And Fox, again, I will say, you know, Fox Searchlight, They didn't go front and center with Brad Pitt.
No.
No.
You know, and
I'm glad that they didn't.
Yeah, me too.
I'm really glad they didn't. Yeah, I wish Brad would not have cast himself in the film, to be completely honest with
you. Second person who said that today.
Yep. Yeah. Especially in that role. It looked a little contrived, to be honest with you. And I like Brad Pitt as much as the next person. But him coming in to save the day, it was contrived.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, since I brought up marketing, I think this is, I got this from the LA Times about Fox Searchlight agreed to distribute the movie it's an independently financed movie. And some of the studio execs, as they always do, they were worried that the film might be too harsh for large numbers of moviegoers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the studio didn't pay anything for the distribution rights, agreeing to share the box office proceeds with the financiers of 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I find that to be, that's a great story from a marketing perspective. It was independently financed. We talked about how it was like 35 days. Mm-hmm. It was a 35-day shoot. Everything's up on the screen. And it just happens to be a very good movie with some very great performances as well. And you can't shy away. Mm-hmm. You can't turn, you know, it was fantastic.
And that's what he was amazing. I wasn't that familiar with his work until this film, and then now I'm going back and seeing other things he's been in. He's phenomenal. I really hope if they get the nominations, and I do believe in possibly the actual some of these awards, I really want all of us, I'm talking about all communities, including the Black community, to give credit where credit is due. These people will not be walking away with Academy Awards because they played a slave in Hollywood.
Yeah.
That's been done before. They'll be getting mm-hmm. these awards because they were the best actors of the season. And I hope that's fully appreciated.
Yeah, I think so too. I hope, I hope so. It should get, you know, it should get the recognition for being the movie that it is. Mm-hmm. Too many times, like, we are forced to watch important movies, mm-hmm. and it feels like you're taking medicine. Exactly.
Yeah. And sometimes you are.
You know, and, you know, going into watching this movie, you know, my friends that I know at Fox had said that it was very good. It was getting pressed by the film festivals that it was in, you know, so this buzz was seeing. So it was a movie that I want to see this movie. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I want to see more Steve McQueen's movies. I want to see
more Steve McQueen too.
Because he came off of Shame and Hunger. Mm-hmm. And just seeing this movie, I want to see his other work. I was like, wow, this was such a mind-blowing movie. Mm-hmm. I want to see those two movies because he touches upon the harsh stories that are hard to tell.
Yeah.
But he executes them so well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you this too, because this is something else, you know, that happens in Hollywood. You know that the movie is gaining a major amount of traction, mm-hmm. and it's a Fox Searchlight film. Mm-hmm. Brad Pitt produced the movie. That Paramount is actually, with Brad Pitt's company, they're feuding over 12 Years a Slave. Paramount is basically saying the executives of Plan B breached the company's deal with the studio by failing to offer Paramount a chance to finance the movie. And of course, this happens in Hollywood. If the movie flopped,
right?
They wouldn't be fighting for
Paramount would be, okay, Brad, when are you doing the next World War Z movie? Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So I just find it interesting when a movie like this does take traction. When these things happen, you know that the relevance of the movie.
Yeah.
Really successful.
Yeah.
You know, one thing we didn't talk about, Phil, what did you think of the movie overall? We didn't talk about what we all thought of this movie.
I really enjoyed it. You know, and please don't.
Not too much, right, Phil? No, just kidding. Go ahead.
As soon as I said it, I knew I was like,
Isn't that nice?
It is the joy of my world to mess with Phil on these issues. Go ahead, Phil.
Isn't that nice? Phil loves it.
That's why you're
movie.
Here.
Right. You love that. No, tell me, I'm comedy. Just going to stop. Okay, go ahead, Phil.
No, but, you know, as a film, it was very well done. You know, and for me, no matter what it is, even when we did our Captain Phillips dissection, I always love talking movies from a movie perspective and trying to cut out the extra contextuals. And as a movie, it was really brilliantly done. And you know what? I'm going to go with Dimitri. It's a well-made movie of high importance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Marissa?
And the realization that this is based off a true story makes it all the more real, more important, mm-hmm. why everyone should see this.
Yeah. Agreed. What are your thoughts?
This movie was great. As a film, it kept my attention the whole time. I realized I knew it was about a free man who was forced into servitude. Mm-hmm. But it was just me watching this whole movie waiting for his freedom to come back. And it really did pay off in the end. And I do still feel bad that this was such a epidemic problem, mm-hmm. that so many people dealt with it. Even though he was one of the lucky people who got out of it, it still affected everyone else. Yeah. And there was that one moment near the beginning of the movie where he made that quick friend who quickly regained his freedom the very next day. And he just left him. And then Ben Solomon gained his freedom back. He got to say his last words to Lupita and then left her.
Yeah.
And it really just shows the importance of freedom, that it means so much to you, but it still affects everyone else.
Here's what I want to say real fast before Ebony and Dimitri have their kind of final thoughts. I want to offer this up, you know, for those of you listening, whatever heritage, whatever color, or sexual orientation, male, female, doesn't really mm-hmm. matter to me. And you know, there's still these problems today, but ironically, they're hidden behind such minutia. And no, because okay, person said this to me on Twitter, and you know, all of this, and so instead of fighting for what's really important out there, we're fighting over such minute things, and no one has, you know, and especially now, right? We talked about the cinematography kind of taking its time and the story taking its time. No one has time because they're going 100 miles an hour over things that don't really matter. And so, you know what, guys? Just take a moment and, you know what? Realize that, A, you don't have it as tough as this.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And if you are, and you know what? In those moments when life is that tough, do something about it. And especially, you know, and I hope that it's not happening to you, but obviously if you see acts like this, do something about it.
Yes.
Yes.
All it takes is one man or woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oppression that's important goes film. All around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My final thoughts, again, such a beautiful story about shaping identity and holding on to it. I think it resonates again with me personally, not just because I'm a Black American, but because I feel like I'm a part of a generation who doesn't have an identity, who's lost, completely and utterly lost culturally. And so when I hear stories like, oh, Miley Cyrus is twerking, she's trying to emulate the Black community. Newsflash, that is not Blackness. Twerking is not the Black community. That is not Black culture. This story is beginning to touch on the beautifulness of what it is to be a Black American in this country. And it's not the only story like that. So I encourage filmmakers to have the kind of courage that Steve McQueen demonstrated in telling a story that, again, some people might not want to see, might be reluctant for whatever reasons. But they're important historically in shaping modern identity.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And as a Caucasian, I don't take claim for Miley Cyrus either. So.
Good, good. No one wants it. No.
So,
yeah,
I was just, you know, I think I was, if you couldn't figure out how I feel about this movie already, yeah, I think this was a really good movie. And I do agree with that author from the Boston Globe. I think it is this country's Schindler's List. But above and beyond, it didn't feel like medicine to me. The pacing to it was, it's a 2-hour and 20-minute movie. It was paced very well. Technique and craft were beautiful and wonderful. The performances were great. Oh. It's a strong film. Mm-hmm. And it is one that during this season that I think should not be ignored. It will not be ignored.
No.
You know, so go see it. If you're watching the show, you've already watched
it.
So, yeah, you know.
It's definitely a movie I'm going to definitely tell as many people as I can. I'm making my family watch this. Yeah. I already told them yesterday, you have to go see this. It's a hard movie, but people need to see this.
Yes, it's worth it.
I'll say one thing. I didn't think that I'd want to see the movie again.
I want to see it again, too.
I
never see movies again.
I do all the time. But after I walked out of this, I was like, oh, I can't sit through this movie again. After my research and letting it sink in, I think I could.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll even look at it with a different perspective, which is the most beautiful thing about movies, and that's why we're here.
Yes, and I give it to everyone who was involved in this movie. It's so beautifully crafted and such amazing story that I have never heard about before, but it really opened my eyes to the harshness of what really has happened and what still resonates today within communities themselves, but it's something that everyone needs to see and be told. So thank you so much for listening to everyone and our discussion about this amazing movie. Where can the people find you?
Everywhere,
you
Marissa. They can find me on Twitter at Ebony_K, EbonyKWilliams.com. You can see my political thoughts and whatnot. Catch me on K-Talk, AM 1150, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week and every other week. All kinds of fun stuff.
Excellent. Yeah. And Demetria, where can we find you?
I have a memory like a sieve. we have Anatomy of a Movie email addresses. Ooh. Phil, help me out. How's that go? Is it DPanos or my name?
And then, you can try info@anatomyofamovie.com, okay. And then we'll connect you with Dimitri.
Great.
There you go. And Phil, where can we find you?
Well, you can follow us at Movie Anatomy on Twitter. We do have a Facebook page, you know, so we're really building this brand. And again, thank you to Siobhan Hughes for joining us earlier from Black Hollywood Lives. 100% real. Great, different perspective at this movie. And thank you, Ebony K. Williams, for joining us.
Oh, wait, can I also shout out Black Hollywood Lives Justice is Served, which I host every Friday with my co-host, Mari.
Yes. Definitely listen to our sister network, BHL, Black Hollywood Live. It's such a great insight to everything that goes on. In Hollywood as well. And you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at SerafiniTV, as well as every other show at AfterBuzz TV, our other sister network. And
go to the site anatomyofamovie.com, folks.
Yes, definitely.
You know, Phil, Marissa did a great job putting this together. They allow you to make comments. We want to read your comments. And go to the movies. And then come back.
Yes.
Watch our shows.
Talk about it with us.
Talk about it with us. Let us know what you think. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you for the next film.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.